He started to beg the Israeli officer, literally, he started to beg him to bomb them. He said, just let us rest, bomb us now. And then when the argument escalated, he started begging the officer for food. He said, if you're going to send planes here anyways, just let them drop any food on us so that we can get any energy to move from this area. And he started to plead with the officer and saying that I was a worker in Israel. A lot of the people here around me used to work in your country. We built your country from scratch and none of this worked. The conversation ended without having any sort of humane reaction from the Israeli officer other than leave the area. The evacuation orders are there only as a pretext to allow Israel to carpet bomb, to indiscriminately bomb a whole area nonstop. So my colleagues on the ground have been saying that since last week, the intensity of the Israeli bombardment is the largest they've ever seen in months. There's basically an airstrike every other minute. There's nonstop artillery fire, gunfire, machine gun fire, as well as Israeli quadcopter drones that are swarming Gaza and shooting people at random. In addition to what you see now with the rampant starvation, a single bag of wheat flour costs about $50. A single pound of sugar costs about $35, and Israel allows a maximum of what would be the equivalent in the GHF sites. It's 20 trucks per day, which is the equivalent of 4 ounces of food, 125 grams of food per person per day, as the only thing. In any concentration camp in human history, people got more food than they do right now in Gaza. So that's the picture you have. With the death trap being the cherry on top, Israel basically laying a mouse trap with fake cheese to Gazans to go to GHF distribution sites to only get shot. It's now basically etched in the minds of everyone I know in Gaza that trying to find food is synonymous to death, especially for kids. They associate it immediately with the killing or the death of loved ones. So my close friend Ibrahim in Gaza City right now, he told me that whenever he tries to leave home to go look for food, his son starts to scream and kick and cry because he understands that leaving to try to find food is a death sentence, and he would rather that they starve than finding his own family being killed. But nonetheless, and that's the most depraved part of it, Amy, is that my friends and family on the ground tell me that once the starvation gets too severe, it dulls your senses. It sort of shuts down your brain. An empty stomach means an empty mind. And your basic survival instinct forces you to walk, to march like a zombie towards these distribution centers, only to get shot on the way. The chances of survival there are very slim. So the overall picture is just a genocide.
And Mohammed Shahada, this carnage, this genocide is occurring while here in the United States, the Trump administration yesterday approved $510 million in additional arms sales to Israel. Your response to this continued U.S. financing of this killing?
Well, basically, at this rate, anyone that wants to know knows what's going on. You have a record number of Israeli experts, human rights experts, that are saying this is a genocide unfolding in Gaza. And Trump's only response has been twofold: to keep showering Israel with gifts, with weaponry, and at the same time to pretend that there is sort of, quote, a breakthrough, an imminent breakthrough in the ceasefire negotiations. Let me be clear, there is none. There are no negotiations to begin with. Qatar yesterday announced there's no progress, there are no negotiations. Hamas as well said there is nobody is reaching out to us to ask for negotiating a ceasefire or the release of Israeli captives. There's just the mirage, the facade of negotiations that Netanyahu and Trump keep reviving every time Gaza jumps back to the headlines, as to numb, to suppress any coverage of Gaza, to create some false hope that there is a breakthrough, to sort of circumvent or suppress any room for pressure on Israel. And the picture is not any better in Europe. Like, if you look at European escalating rhetoric towards Israel, it was also an empty maneuver to just circumvent pressure to act. So, for example, European governments like Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Norway, Western governments, they basically recently imposed sanctions on Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. The sanctions were very well choreographed, articulated in a way as to evade holding the Israeli government accountable. They only penalized the two ministers for statements, not actions, and for statements on the West Bank, not Gaza. Because if they had looked into actions or statements on Gaza, it would have incriminated the entire Israeli government. So what we see is basically just mere headline-grabbing gestures that are there to buy time while at the same time continuing to funnel unrestricted, unconstrained support for the very genocide that those countries are claiming to be concerned about.
Mohammed Shahada, we want to thank you for joining us from Copenhagen, writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. This news from Al Jazeera, Britain's High Court has ruled the government's decision to allow the export of Lockheed Martin F-35 jet parts to Israel is lawful, despite accepting that they could be used in breach of international humanitarian law. Next up, we go to Geneva to speak with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk. He says Israel's committing ethnic cleansing in Gaza. Back in 20 seconds.
To the misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime. It's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by this chorus of complaint. It's a sure sign.
Tomorrow's going to be a better day. That's Billy Bragg singing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I was in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday, on Monday, at the headquarters of the United Nations Human Rights Council. I had the chance to sit down and speak with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, about a number of issues. In today's segment, we're going to look at Israel's attack on Gaza. We spoke soon after Israel issued new forced evacuation orders for Palestinians in areas of northern Gaza. In a statement last month, Volker Türk characterized Israel's actions in Gaza as ethnic cleansing, saying, quote, "This latest barrage of bombs forcing people to move amid the threat of intensified attacks, the methodical destruction of entire neighborhoods, and the denial of humanitarian assistance underline that there appears to be a push for a permanent demographic shift in Gaza that's in defiance of international law and is tantamount to ethnic cleansing," unquote. I ask Volker Türk about his comments.
You must imagine over the last over 20 months or so that the population inside Gaza has been displaced multiple times. I've heard it directly from some of our staff who told me that they had to move from the north to the south, back to the north, and back to the south, and within these areas again and again. So it shows a group of people multiply displaced, and with the latest orders, they are essentially now confined to one-fifth of the territory. So you basically ask people to go again to one-fifth of the territory and empty up the land. That's what prompted me to call it ethnic displacement and ethnic cleansing. Mm.
And just this past weekend, officials in Gaza say at least 81 Palestinians were killed, 400 injured, just over a day period. You have accused Israel of inflicting horrifying, unconscionable suffering on Palestinians. What is your response to the latest developments?
Well, you have seen that they established the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is essentially a militarized form of providing humanitarian assistance. We have seen at least over 600 people killed when they tried to go to these distribution points. We used to have, when the UN was still able to work a little bit more, we were having about 400 distribution points. Now it's limited to 4 or 5, and it's heavily militarized. And as a result, you see people being killed, you see chaos, because the fundamental principles of humanitarian action are not respected. So yes, humanitarian action is extremely important in these circumstances, and it's just not happening at the scale and speed that is required in order to save people's lives.
Can you talk about Israel's attack on UNRWA itself, on the UN agency?
So the fact that UNRWA was vilified in the way that it was actually shows that there is a total misunderstanding of the role of the United Nations. We are here to provide relief. We are here to help people in need. We are here also in humanitarian action to do this type of work. Unfortunately, we were not allowed to do it, and UNRWA was the prime target in all of this, which is very, very unfortunate and has really real-life consequences.
Is it a war crime?
I mean, the UNRWA, there are many things that happen in this war that are clearly war crimes. Collective punishment, issues of denying of humanitarian assistance. It's a very complex legal issue how to deal with UNRWA, and in fact, it's currently before the International Court of Justice.
I mean, the number of healthcare workers that have been killed, the hundreds of journalists who have been killed, those that are there to provide humanitarian aid. I just have to ask, the United Nations some 80 years ago was founded to end war, promote fundamental human rights, reaffirm international law. When you watch what is unfolding in Gaza, you might think the UN is totally useless.
Well, the principles are there, and the principles need to be respected. Let's not forget, why was the United Nations created? The United Nations were created after two world wars, horrific suffering, 60 million people in Europe alone displaced as refugees, the Holocaust, atrocity crimes, massive violations of human rights. There was a sentiment, never again. We are going to establish a world order that respects territorial integrity, independence, that respects human rights and international humanitarian law. And yes, 80 years later, I'm indeed shocked at what I see around the world, because we have the highest number of conflicts and utter disrespect for international law. And that is worrying and should wake us all up, because we don't need a world where anarchy reigns and chaos.
How do you see a ceasefire taking place after Iran, Israel and U.S. bombing Iran? That happened quite quickly, but not in Gaza. The violence is only intensifying.
No, I really hope, my most fervent hope is that there is a permanent ceasefire, that all the remaining hostages are released unconditionally, that indeed humanitarian aid is finally coming in at a scale and a magnitude that is required, and that there will be a political solution, which means a two-state solution. There's no way around that. And yeah, I mean, and we can never give up on any of this, even when at the moment it looks very unrealistic, but one should never ever cast this aside. That's the only solution for both Israelis and Palestinians to live side by side in peace.
That's Volker Türk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. We were speaking at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday, where he had just given an address about climate change. He says men have stopped wearing ties in Europe with the heat dome so intense right now. So next up, we're going to talk about climate change and the rising temperatures with climatologist Michael Mann. Stay with us.
Man built a railroad, man got a move. Man made a record, put a needle to the groove. Man been up, oh, and man been down. Now man don't want no one around. Well, first they stole our language, then they stole our names, then they stole the things that brought us fame. And they stole our neighbors, and they stole our streets, and they left us to die on Recon Beach.
Rican Beach, performed by Hooray for the Riff Raff's Linda Segarra at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour looking at climate news as a massive heat dome is bringing record temperatures to much of Europe, with forecasters warning of even more extreme heat in the coming days. Spain and Portugal just recorded their hottest ever June temperatures. Nearly two dozen cities in Italy are under red alert heat advisories. In Turkey, more than 50,000 people have evacuated fast-spreading wildfires. France also saw its first fires of the season erupt. This comes after most of North America sweltered under, to say the least, hotter-than-average temperatures in June. Scientists say the burning of fossil fuels by humans is the primary cause of global warming. This week, the Senate's debating measures to include in Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Budget bill is set to shape in U.S. fossil fuel policy in ways expected to accelerate fossil fuel extraction, in part by cutting hundreds of billions of dollars of clean energy incentives. In fact, taxing more clean energy incentives. This comes as the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights in the context of climate change presented a new report Monday on the imperative of defossilizing our economies. This is Elisa Morguera addressing the UN Human Rights Council.
So what does defossilization mean? It entails prioritizing the phase out of fossil fuels, including various forms of financing them, within and beyond the energy sector. It means recognizing and prioritizing the phase out of fossil fuels as the single most impactful health contribution. Defossilization underscores the need to focus on fossil fuels, also in connection with the growing production of plastics and petrochemicals, which cause an additional layer of human rights harms and further diminish nature's contribution to climate regulation and human resilience. Defossilizing our economies then means tackling all the financial benefits the fossil fuel companies are still gaining.
Morguera also called for a ban on fossil fuel industry lobbying and advertising and urged criminal penalties for those who spread disinformation about the climate crisis. For more, we're joined by Michael Mann, the presidential distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science, University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability and the Media. His most recent research has been profiled in UPenn Today under the headline, Heat Domes and Flooding Have Nearly Tripled Since the 50s. His forthcoming book with Dr. Peter Hotez is titled Science Under Siege. His previous books include Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Mann. I was just in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday. The heat dome was intense. And as we know in Europe, they don't have very much air conditioning at all. It's believed tens of thousands of people have died over the last years in Europe as a result of the intense heat. Can you talk about what you have found around the intensification of the increase of heat domes from the U.S. to Europe and beyond?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to be with you. And, you know, at some level, this isn't that complicated. You make the planet hotter, you're going to have more frequent and intense heat extremes. And we are seeing that. Our climate models capture that, and they predict that that will get much worse in the future if we, you know, as you allude to, continue to burn fossil fuels and warm up the planet. At the same time, there's some subtle mechanisms when it comes to how the pattern of warming of the planet is changing the Northern Hemisphere jet stream. And some of our own research suggests that that pattern of warming, in particular, the fact that the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet, is actually changing the jet stream in such a way that it's more likely to get stuck in one of those very wavy patterns that you see on a weather map. And those waves are associated with big high and low pressure systems that alternatively mean heat, drought, and wildfires in one place or excessive floods in other places. Those wiggles in the jet stream are tending to get larger and they get locked in place. So the same location is under a heat dome. day after day, like we've seen in North America this summer, like we're seeing in Europe right now. And that mechanism is actually not very well captured in the climate models. It's an important point because critics of climate policy like to say uncertainty is a reason not to act. It's just the opposite. Our models may, in fact, be underestimating the impact that climate change is already having when it comes to these damaging and deadly weather extremes.
And Professor Mann, what exactly is a heat dome?
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's just an area of very high pressure, very hot, dry air. We've seen a number of them out west in recent years. We had one here in Philadelphia. We were under one of those heat domes. We had triple digit temperatures, and it's also fairly humid in this part of the country. So you add those very high temperatures, that excessive humidity, and you're talking about deadly heat. Here in Philadelphia, we have a very large underserved population of people who are especially susceptible to heat stress. And so this is a real concern. It's not a distant concern. It's something that is impacting us now.
And meanwhile, we have the Trump administration not only moving in this new bill to reduce subsidies for solar and wind energy, but also to incentivize coal production, declaring the coal industry critical to the United States. What do you make of this direction that the current administration is going in?
Yeah, it's tragic. History will not judge them kindly, because at a time when we need to be accelerating that transition away from fossil fuels towards clean energy, they're doing just the opposite. They're doing everything they can to block the continued expansion of wind and solar and geothermal and clean energy solutions. And the rest of the world is moving on. So what we have to recognize here is that this is, even if you don't care about the climate, even if you don't care about the human health consequences, any of that, if you care about the economy, this is the worst possible thing for American competitiveness, because the rest of the world recognizes that clean energy is the future. And right now we're doubling down on antiquated fossil fuel energy in a way that is making us less and less competitive.
I want to ask you a quick question. Dr. Mann, this just happened. The U.S. Global Change Research Program's website, globalchange.gov, was taken down, along with information on how global warming is affecting the country. What's the significance of this?
Yeah, I actually encountered that yesterday. I couldn't believe my eyes when I heard that had happened, and I went to look for those reports, those congressionally mandated national climate assessment reports. They're all gone. You can't access them online anymore. And the attitude seems to be on the part of this administration that if we pretend climate change doesn't exist, if we stop measuring it, if we stop scientists from talking about it and publishing about it, that somehow it'll just evaporate. It's such a cynical and dangerous way of looking at this problem.
I remember when I was growing up, librarians were all saying, we need paper copies of everything as the internet, took over. And I just thought they were so old-fashioned, they couldn't get used to the idea that the internet was the reservoir of, all global information. But all of this is being wiped away. But let me get your response to podcaster Joe Rogan's interview with Senator Bernie Sanders. Rogan pushed back when Senator Sanders said, quote, the last 10 years have been the warmest on Earth.
There are some people who think climate change is a hoax. It ain't a hoax. I think the last 10 years have been the warmest on record. And we can create millions of good-paying jobs transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency, to solar, to wind, and other sustainable energies.
I think the climate change issue is very complicated. And I think, did you see the Washington Post piece that they wrote where they did this long-term view? First of all, the reality is that the Earth's temperature has never been static, right? We both agree on that. It's always been up and down. There's been ice ages and heat waves. And then the Washington Post looked at it. What was the time period that they looked at? That essentially they found that we're in a cooling period, that the Earth over the past X amount of years, and this was like a very inconvenient discovery, but they had to report the data, and kudos to them for doing that.
So that's podcaster Joe Rogan interviewing Senator Bernie Sanders. Professor Michael Mann, can you respond? He says, talking about this cooling period.
Yeah, you know, they say a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And here, you know, he probably read a headline, this Washington Post headline, and didn't even understand the headline, you know, let alone actually read the article. It was about a research article that had been published, I believe, in the journal Nature, which I reviewed at the time and wrote about it. And he got it 180 degrees wrong. What that article actually showed was when you look back over tens of millions of years, and I talk about, you know, the lessons from Earth history and what we can learn from them in our fragile moment. And this is related to this article. They're looking at the changes in climate that have taken place over millions of years and using a climate model to figure out what it tells us about how sensitive the climate is to increases in CO2. Now, in the past, on hundreds of millions of year timescales, those changes in carbon dioxide are driven by very long-term changes in explosive volcanic activity, which puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere on timescales of tens of millions of years. I mean, what it shows is that the climate may actually be more sensitive to those increases in CO2. Of course, we are increasing CO2 at a much more rapid rate, a million times faster today. And if anything, what this study shows is that the climate may be more sensitive to this increase in carbon dioxide from human activity today. So he didn't understand what he was reading. He might have heard some talking points from conservative radio or television. And, you know, this is misinformation. Some would call it disinformation, intentional misinformation to mislead the public about what is arguably the greatest threat that we face.
And Professor Mann, your upcoming book, Science, is titled Science Under Siege. The battle over climate change is just part of this war on science of the Trump administration. I'm wondering if you could talk about the impact on your colleagues, on scientists across the United States as university research is being attacked, as accepted knowledge is being questioned, what this means for the future development of the scientific community in this country.
Yeah, thanks. You know, the book, in a way, is sadly prophetic because Peter Hotez, a public health vaccinologist, vaccine scientist, and I began writing this book more than a year ago. And we had no idea what was in store or how relevant it would be to where we are today, because it really is about this dual attack that we've seen when it comes to the science behind vaccines and the public health measures necessary to deal with pandemics like COVID-19 or the science of climate change. In both cases, we have seen the science attacked for purely ideological reasons. And as you allude to, with this current administration, we're seeing that assault now, accelerate in a way that we've never seen before. This sort of assault on the science of vaccines and COVID-19, the science of climate. And we're seeing the defunding of research in this area. We're seeing researchers attacked and vilified and threatened because of the research that they do, because it's inconvenient, again, to certain ideological interests who want to see us double down on fossil fuels, or who have bought into the idea that, you know, vaccines are a dangerous conspiracy. In both cases, the consequences are deadly. People are losing their lives, and many more people will lose their lives if we continue down this current path of anti-science that we're going down here in the United States. It's a very dangerous time for all of us. And, you know, the irony here is that this is a country that was built on science and technology. And the wonders of, you know, modern life are due to the fact that this country valued scientists and it promoted and supported scientists for decades. And now, because certain areas of science have become inconvenient, again, to certain ideologically driven individuals and groups and industries, we find science under an attack. You know, again, there's almost no precedent. You have to go back to, you know, the early 1900s,
Five seconds.
Stalin's Russia You know, the assault on scientists that happened then.
Michael Mann, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.